Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Columbia Care second quarter 2019 earnings conference call. I am your operator for today's call. Please note that all lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. This call is being recorded for replay purposes. A replay of the audio webcast will be available in the investor section of the company's website approximately 2 hours after completion of the call and will be archived for 30 days. If you would like to ask a question on today's call, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate you are in the question queue. I would now like to turn the call over to your host for today, Gary Santo, Vice President of Investor Relations for Columbia Care.
Thank you, Devin, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for Columbia Care's second quarter 2019 earnings conference call. With me today are Nicholas Vita, our Chief Executive Officer, Lars Boesgaard, our Chief Financial Officer, and David Hart, our Chief Operating Officer. Earlier this afternoon, we issued a press release reporting our second quarter results, which we also filed with the applicable Canadian Securities Regulatory Authorities on SEDAR. You can find the release as well as a replay of this call in the investor section of our corporate website. Please note that the remarks we make today regarding future expectations, plans, and prospects for the company constitute forward-looking statements within the meaning of applicable Canadian securities laws. Actual results may differ materially from those indicated by such forward-looking statements as a result of various important factors, which we disclose in more detail in the risk factors section of our final prospectus, dated March 21, 2019, filed with the applicable Canadian securities regulatory authorities, and can be found at www.sedar.com. We remind you that any forward-looking statements represent our views as of today and should not be relied upon as representing our views as of any subsequent date. While we may update any such forward-looking statements in the future, we specifically disclaim any obligation to do so except as otherwise required by applicable law. Also, please note that on today's call we will refer to certain non-IFRS financial measures, such as adjusted EBITDA and gross profit margin, excluding changes in fair value of biological assets. These measures do not have any standardized meaning prescribed by IFRS and may not be comparable to similar measures presented by other companies. Columbia Care considers certain non-IFRS measures to be meaningful indicators of the performance of its business in addition to, but not as a substitute for, our IFRS results. A reconciliation of such non-IFRS financial measures to their nearest comparable measure is included in our press release issued earlier today. Nick will begin his comments today with a high-level overview of our accomplishments during the second quarter, followed by Lars, who will provide an overview of our financial performance. Nick will then provide an update on our strategic initiatives. After prepared remarks, the team will take questions. With that, I will turn the call over to Nick.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you all for joining us today. We greatly appreciate your continued support. We're very excited at Columbia Care to announce our quarterly results today, with a 102% increase top line year over year and a 50% top line increase quarter over quarter for revenue. It was a very strong performer across a number of markets, and what I plan on doing in this section of the conference call is just delineating a few highlights that we can then turn to during the Q&A. In the past 45 days, we've launched 4 markets, which brings our total number of markets open up to 10, leaving several markets available for growth. Virginia, New Jersey, Maryland, others are planned to open up later on this year. We have 63 discrete facilities that are open or under development. In terms of dispensary openings, if you exclude the dispensaries that are positioned for approval currently, we have 17 operational, but we're on track for 50 by year end. We expect to have 20 open in Florida alone, and we expect to maintain continuity of access to pharmacists in every market. Cultivation and manufacturing update. We have a number of sort of important disclosures to convey to you all, including sort of the 50 acres that we've planted in Pennsylvania, with access up to 100 acres for total planting space for production of industrial hemp, for conversion into to CBD and hemp-based extracts. In New York, we have a partnership with a co-op and a number of local farmers giving us access to another 40 acres. We also have expansion plans underway in Arcadia, Florida, in Massachusetts, and Illinois. We have build-outs ongoing, and again, in Florida, California, Virginia, and New Jersey. In terms of our partnership and retail distribution, our produce vaporized delivery device is in beta testing in New York and Massachusetts. We expect full rollout by end of the year. In terms of our CBD sort of non-THC retail channel distribution efforts, our Zittimer pilot launch, which is a an independent pharmacy in New York, went exceptionally well. Our products were among the top revenue earners among all the CBD products sold on their platform, and we expect to begin expanding that in earnest throughout the country at other independent drugstore channels and retail channels. Our e-commerce program is underway, and we expect to launch sometime later this quarter. In terms of our Columbia National Credit Card, as we mentioned in a press release earlier in the quarter, we've rolled out the Columbia National Credit Card in New York, Massachusetts, Delaware, Illinois, and Arizona. We have 30% more accounts than we did the prior quarter. That growth is having a fairly significant impact on the number of important statistics for the company, and we expect to have it launched in all of our markets by year end. In terms of the capital markets update, during the quarter, we worked to increase visibility. We've presented at 12 conferences, met with over 60 potential investors, met with over 60 companies comprising of 125 different investors and individuals. We completed our listing on the OTC in the U.S. to have a U.S. dollar-denominated security, and on the FS, the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, for a euro-denominated security. And we announced the launch of our corporate repurchase program as well. So with that as the benchmarks for the quarter, let me turn it over to Lars for the financial update, and then we can jump into the strategic portion of the conversation.
Thanks, Nick. I'll begin with the key takeaways from our second quarter of 2019. And starting with revenue, and as Nick just mentioned, we reported total revenues in the second quarter of $19.3 million, which was an increase of 102% over last year. This was all and entirely driven by organic growth in our dispensary network and by increased per-store sales. And perhaps more tellingly, we saw a 50% growth in revenue quarter over quarter compared to the first quarter of 2019. Our gross profit before fair value adjustments was $5.4 million, which is largely unchanged compared to the previous year. Gross profit, including fair value adjustments, was $5.2 million, which was also similar to the gross profit recognized in 2018. Operating expenses for the second quarter was $39.3 million, an increase of $31.5 million compared to the previous year. This increase was primarily caused by the recognition of $11.1 million in non-cash listing fee expense, reflecting the consolidation of assets acquired in our reverse takeover transaction in April, as well as $7.3 million increase in stock-based compensation expense. The remaining increase was primarily due to increased professional fees and salaries and benefits. Also, during the second quarter, we recognized expenses of approximately $1.1 million related to our Go Public transaction. Our adjusted EBITDA for the second quarter was negative $11.4 million compared to a negative $1.7 million for the previous year. And that lower adjusted EBITDA was primarily caused by our higher operating expenses. As of June 30, our cash on hand balance was $125 million, and we had no material debt position. Now, turning to our results for the first 6 months of 2019, our revenue for the 6 months was $32.2 million, which was an increase of 75% compared to the same period in 2018. This growth was, again, entirely organic, as we added no new business through acquisitions. Gross profit before fair value adjustments was $9.8 million, an increase of 12% compared to 2018. Gross profit including fair value adjustments was $3 million compared to gross profits of $6.4 million in 2018. This difference was driven by decreased recognition of fair value of unharvested biological assets, including inventory sold during the quarter. Operating expenses in the first 6 months of 2019 was $61.2 million compared to $17.2 million for the same period in 2018. The increase was primarily due to the listing fee discussed previously and $8.8 million in increased share-based compensation expense, as well as increased professional fees and salaries and benefits. Finally, adjusted EBITDA for the first 6 months of 2019 was negative $21.8 million compared to negative $4 million in 2018. As well as for the first quarter, the difference there was primarily due to higher operating expenses. Yep. And with that, I will turn the call back to the operator.
Thank you, Lars. Just a few strategic points to touch upon. First, I think that some of the takeaways that we'd like to share with the investor community really begins with the strategy that we've adopted and executed on since the founding of the company. As Lars and Gary and I have all mentioned, and as you've heard from us in the past, the company's been built using a sort of organic, very focused strategy, really trying to establish a best-in-breed operator that's fully integrated in all of its markets, focused specifically on the health and wellness market, which encompasses medical and encompasses a large portion of what most people consider to be the adult use market. We've been able to establish sort of a new benchmark and expectation for the acceleration and for the growth rates of the top line based on the fact that we raised capital. And that capital has enabled us to really expand upon the markets where we've had success in our sort of day-to-day pursuit activities through application processes. I think what you'll begin to see us take a more proactive stance in doing is the following. One is to leverage the existing infrastructure and the data we've collected to continue to make exceptional decisions from a capital allocation and from a resource allocation perspective. All of the decisions we've made to innovate new products, to create intellectual property, to develop a differentiated platform, and to really sort of accelerate and extend our competitive and sustainable advantages have been a byproduct of our ability to really leverage each individual component of the integrated model, which involves cultivation, manufacturing, and distribution. Two, you'll begin to see us look increasingly at external methods of enhancing our growth. And so even though we've experienced significant growth organically up to this point, you shouldn't be surprised to see us be involved in M&A transactions if the financial terms and the strategic sense is there. We've laid out what our strategy is, and we'll continue to adhere to that strategy in a very disciplined fashion. And we're also very focused on a number of financial metrics, including return on invested capital and dilution. And three, when we think about how we want to stage different decisions, either strategic or tactical, it really strikes a balance between maintaining our growth rates on the top line, expanding our margin over time, and really hitting the types of long-term gross and EBITDA margins that businesses like ours should expect to see, which is really a byproduct of site selection, it's a byproduct of market selection, it's a byproduct of product selection and product mix, both of wholesale and proprietary manufactured products. So with that, let me turn it back over to Gary, and we can transition to Q&A.
Sure. I think that concludes our prepared remarks, operator. So, Devin, if you could open the line up for questions and answers.
Thank you. We will now be conducting a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we poll for questions. Our first question comes from the line of Matt Bottomley with Canaccord Genuity. Please proceed with your question.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for taking the questions. Just wanted to touch on the growth, the sequential growth that you guys posted in Q2, so about 50% quarter over quarter. Wanted to confirm that is all organic. And I get a lot of questions as to how your recreational stores in Massachusetts are trending. So I don't know if there's much you can say on that at this point, but any color on that would be appreciated as well.
So, Matt, I can confirm that growth is all organic. It comes from the existing portfolio of licenses we've had. Massachusetts has been a very, very strong performer for us. We've seen 2 out of our 3 dispensaries convert to adult use in the Massachusetts market. But if you recall, we have a number of markets, what we consider to be crossover markets, where you have adult use and medical programs. So this is the same type of growth I think others have seen in Massachusetts we've experienced, and we continue to see an expansion of the overall market across the board.
And just a housekeeping item on that, can you just confirm the number of dispensaries that you had open at June 30th versus today? I think it's about 17, you said.
As of year end in June, it was 16, and then we have how many in the final stages of approval? We just announced Puerto Rico. We've got Ohio's coming up soon.
Yes, I think at the end of June.
End of June, it was 17, 16.
16, and then Puerto Rico came in after that, and there were a few others that.
So at the end of June, it was 16.
And so that's up from about 15 in Q1?
13.
Okay. And then I just wanted to touch on Florida as well. So I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. Still have plans to open 20 locations this year. Given that we're a month into the following quarter here, any guided numbers on how many you hope to have opened this quarter versus in Q4, or just a percentage split between those two quarters of having those locations opened?
So we really haven't provided that guidance because there's a lot of variability at the municipal level, but we are focused on hitting that mark by the end of this calendar year.
Right, and that will have 50 retail in total, and you expect 20 of those to be Florida?
In the neighborhood of 50, and as close to 20 as we can get in Florida, that's correct.
Great. Next, just on the M&A you mentioned just at the end there, can you give us any color as to what, given, obviously having appropriate terms and valuation and everything that goes along with it, what types of assets you're looking for? Is it to expand your retail footprint further? Is it more on the product development side? Anything, any preferences in terms of what you're looking at?
So I think there are really two primary categories, but we've looked at a wide range of different alternatives. The first relates to distribution, and distribution can be bricks and mortars, it can be a technology platform, it could be a whole range of things. Our ability to reach out and maintain relationships directly with the consumers and to help them through the cannabis journey is something that we view as a core competency, especially because we have a differentiated service-based model. Second, we've looked at technology platforms. And technology platforms can impact everything from manufacturing to cultivation, and sometimes involve in-licensing of technologies to actually enhance existing product lines. And so we're really thinking about it from not only sort of a core operational perspective, but from the perspective of creating differentiated products that have residual sustainable value through intellectual, through IP, and through know-how in sort of broader open market environments.
Perfect. And just last question on my end, just given the inflection point you guys are at with different market rollouts, is it fair to assume that your EBITDA line might decrease a little more before it inflects towards being positive, just given that you have, I think it's four or five markets in the last, less than 60 days? Is that a fair assumption, or is it not clear enough to make that determination?
I think that's a fair assumption to be conservative. What we've always seen is that there's a J curve associated with building out our facilities. And, some markets we've seen an exceptionally quick pace to get to profitability. Other markets, we've seen a longer pace. It really depends on the regulatory environment. So I would say that if you look at a market like Ohio, where it's relatively uncharted territory versus a market like California, you might expect to see different timelines there. But from the standpoint of how we're thinking about the business and making sure we're managing our cash and managing our operational overhead, we've assumed that by compressing all of our CapEx from 2021 and 2020 into 2019, we can effectively get over the trough of the J curve in the next 12 months, and then really begin to see some acceleration of EBITDA margin to commensurate with the top line growth that we expect to see accelerating into the year end this year and into well throughout 2020.
Okay, great. Thanks, Nick. That's it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Robert Fagan with GMP Securities. Please proceed with your question.
Hey guys, congrats on the great top line growth there in the quarter. I was just wondering if you might be able to give us some ideas of the drivers of growth there. If you're not willing to speak state by state, would you be able to give us an idea of the kind of growth that was coming outside of Massachusetts?
Absolutely. When we think about, there are three main contributors. Obviously, markets that convert from a medical only to a broader, let's call it adult use or recreational slash medical convention, obviously are going to have an impact. the introduction of new markets will also have an impact. And so the ability to sort of, let's call it, sweat our assets and really initiate wholesale revenue as well as retail-oriented revenue. And then I think that the third sort of just general statement I would make is that there are some markets that have that were originally structured as very regulated medical markets that have become much less regulated. And I can point to markets like Pennsylvania as main drivers of growth. But it's been fairly sustained throughout the portfolio. And what we're, you know, one of the things we're very excited about is that some of the new markets that we have coming online are sort of almost more conventional in the way you can think about growth rates and sort of market adoption curves, because they already exist. So when we compare the complexity of trying to sort of figure out where a Delaware might go versus a San Diego, obviously San Diego is sort of a very well-known, large, and existing and growing market. So.
Okay, well, thanks for that. Maybe I could just switch gears a bit to the gross margin, which I noticed was pretty stable from last quarter, and, you know, kind of on a margin basis seems to have declined. Is it possible that you guys are recognizing some costs in your production cost line that are associated to plants that have been grown but not yet harvested? Any color on the profitability there would be great.
Certainly, I think the one of the single biggest impacts to our gross margin was the fact that we, in a couple of markets, we haven't opened up our fully integrated manufacturing process. So, for example, there are markets where we have our dispensaries open, but our manufacturing capability is opening, you know, in the next month or two or 2 months. And because we're buying product in from the wholesale market, you know, that will have an impact on our margin. And second, in Massachusetts, we actually had to purchase from third parties to supplement our available inventory. And so it was really just a product mix and a sourcing of that product mix that had sort of one of the most significant impacts to our margin. I don't know, Lars, if you have anything to add to that.
No, I echo that, right. I mean, as you pointed out yourself, as we are building new manufacturing capacity in some of our expansion markets, you're absolutely right. That does cause inefficiencies, which are reflected in the in our cost of revenue and consequently in our gross profit.
Okay, great. So, I mean, would that be more than just Massachusetts, where you were wholesale sourcing, or mainly just in that market?
It's other markets as well.
Okay, great.
And so what I would expect, just to give you some sense of the trajectory, as we begin to roll out our own manufacturing, pipeline and cultivation supply, you would expect to see our margin increase to a normalized level across the markets.
Great. Looking forward to that. I guess just on that kind of same subject, could you give us kind of your strategic priorities for expanding your production? Kind of on a ranked market by market basis, are you focusing on perhaps Illinois to expand there, obviously maybe Massachusetts, or can you just give us an idea of where you're going to grow your capacity?
Let me give you a very high level response and I'll turn it over to David. The short story is, you know, of our 15 markets, we currently have ongoing expansion projects in 13 of them. So we're expanding our capacity to produce, to manufacture, to package, and distribute in almost every single jurisdiction. The priorities are really based on the supply-demand curves we see. We haven't given that specific guidance, but what I can tell you is that, you know, the goal is to right-size our infrastructure to match the demand profile of what we're seeing. And in markets where we expect there to be a conversion from, say, a medical only to an adult use environment, you know, we're obviously planning ahead, but we don't want to have an oversupply. We want to make sure that it's a good balance between the supply and demand curve, because there's a cost. There's obviously a cost to deploying the capital, and we want to make sure that we maintain a reasonable cash balance so that we have as much flexibility as possible. I don't know, David, if you have anything to add to that.
Sure. So we have, in terms of our existing markets, we have expansion for K
canopy in for manufacturing in New York, Massachusetts, Illinois, Delaware, and Arizona. And we're building in new markets, California, Ohio, Virginia, New Jersey. Florida, we have an existing footprint that we're going through an expansion as well. So we do have projects in essentially every market in terms of expansion of both canopy and or manufacturing throughput capabilities.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Matthew Pallotta with Echelon Wealth Partners. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Looking to get a little bit of extra detail, if you guys can, on the plans for CBD. I know you said you were selling in a boutique pharmacy there in New York. And just with the recent issues we've seen surrounding the FDA comment letters and reprimanding some of the businesses, is there any concern there running afoul if they're selling any sort of ingestible products through those channels? I'll take your comments on that.
Certainly. So I would break the CBD conversation into two geographic regions, the United States and then the rest of the world. Within the United States, as you all know, we were one of the first companies to begin to accumulate licenses in for CBD manufacturing and production from industrial hemp. Today, I think we're one of, if not the largest, sort of producer of industrial hemp in Pennsylvania. We have a substantial operation in New York, and we plan on expanding that to make sure we maintain the continuity of our supply chain across the country. The problems that we've seen other people deal with the FDA, I think, has to do with the way in which they position the products and the marketing decisions that were made to support the introduction of those products. One of the reasons why we always try to sort of aim small and miss small, and by that I mean we start off with a local pharmacy that we have a very strong relationship with. We work with our team. We educate them on our products. We roll out the right products that they're comfortable with, that everyone's comfortable with from a legal perspective, rather than going for the sort of the immediate home run. Is that we've seen this song, we've heard this song before. If you recall, Target had the same problem where they had to pull their CBD products off the shelves just a few years ago. And so knowing that you really only get one chance to be put on one of these massive, massive retailer shelves, we would rather have a proven business model and a proven product offering that we can point to that not only sort of is supported by the regulatory insights, but also by the, let's call it the risk coefficients, whether they be product focused or operationally focused. We took a definitively more conservative approach, which is to say, let's put it on some friendly, let's make sure that our infrastructure works, let's make sure that all the things we're doing pass muster from a regulatory and compliance perspective, let's make sure that we have the FDA experts come in and give us guidance on how to actually manufacture these products and where those products are appropriately placed. Let's make sure there's a real merchandising strategy, not just simply having availability of inventory. And all of those things take a great deal of time. But our view is that by taking this sort of, sort of step approach rather than sort of going for the home run, we hope to be able to avoid some of those pitfalls because there's obviously a long-term consequence for sort of underperformance, especially when you're talking about institutions that have very long memories. Outside the United States, we're taking a very similar approach from a regulatory and a product and a manufacturing perspective, but we have a complementary and a parallel supply chain. So the products that we are going to be selling into the European market, the CBD products, different form factors are approvable and appropriate for different regions within Europe. All of them require the same manufacturing standard, but the form factors, the way in which we position them in the marketplaces, whether you're talking about Europe or the UK or Germany, require a different level of expertise. So again, we like to sort of start off small, work our way up, perfect the operating model, and then kind of lean in. And you're going to see us take a very similar approach overseas as you've seen us taking here. But so far, so good. We've had great results. Zitimers is one of the most well-known independent pharmacy chains in New York City, and for the first time in their many, many year history, they actually kept our products in all of their windows 2 months in a row, which is a big deal, and it was really being driven by consumer interest and consumer demand. So we're very fortunate to have good partners like that. We're very fortunate to have a learning curve that's predicated on applying the data that we're able to pull out of the markets, And, you know, because we like to believe we've done a good job of managing expectations, we think we can continue to show sequential and year-over-year growth without necessarily having to sort of, you know, hit a home run every time, because this is the way we can provide the least dilutive, least, you know, best risk-adjusted rate of return for our investors.
Okay, thanks. Secondly, I would just, if you guys have any color you can provide on the California store in Pacific Beach and how growth there has been tracking, you know, say relative to the also recently approved rec stores in Mass. And if you also have any plans when you're speaking about acquiring distribution assets as one of your two M&A priorities, do you have any plans to expand retail in California?
So let me take the second question first. California is a market that is very interesting. I think we've been very quiet on delineating our California strategy because I think there's an enormous amount of value to be had by maintaining our strategic sort of priorities and views closer to the chest. And so we haven't really telegraphed that to the market yet, but we are certainly looking at California, and we're looking at trying to find the most cost-effective ways to give us access to what is arguably one of the single largest jurisdictions on the planet. In comparison to Massachusetts, we just opened up San Diego recently, so I don't think that you can compare one to the other. But what I will say is that, you know, the San Diego market, because it has a limited license municipal structure, is one of the markets that we've targeted in California and one where we feel very good about. The location we have in San Diego is absolutely excellent, so we're thrilled about that. But, you know, we love Lowell, we love Greenfield, we love Boston. And so it's hard to sort of say is one outperforming versus another. I think they're both sort of performing in line with the way we'd hoped, meaning Massachusetts is doing well. The team is doing a great job. California, the team is cutting their teeth. It's got an experienced leadership group out there. They're doing a great job as well. You know, we're very excited about opening up California's manufacturing infrastructure because we think that we have a portfolio of products that no one's even seen, where we think there's a massive, massive unmet need and demand profile that exists. But, you know, that's yet to come. So we're, you know, I would say we're happy with both of them. They both continue to track in the right direction. And, you know, we're going to hopefully see similar trends across the country.
Awesome. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Graeme Kreindler with Eight Capital. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, hi there, and thanks for taking my questions here. I just wanted to follow up on the comments before about the credit card program, and I was just wondering if there are any metrics you can provide in terms of, you know, early data of how customer spend has changed for a customer who has adopted the credit card program, and how might that purchase behavior have changed since then?
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to. And by the way, before I hand this over to David, just to give a little bit of insight, this is a pilot program we initiated because every single operator in the market, whether they're a mom and pop or an MSO in the United States, is facing the same adoption curve. And this is not just a B2C issue. This is a B2B issue. People having to transact in cash or using debit card is inherently cost inefficient and operationally inefficient. And it adds operational risks to the business models that I think people are rightfully frustrated with. Before I hand it over to David, I can tell you that this is an asset that we have proven out in our minds. We're rolling it out nationally in all of our markets, specifically with the intention of making sure that this can become potentially a solution to one of the most important bottlenecks the industry is facing. And so it's more than just this was never designed to be an interest income opportunity. This was designed to be an opportunity to actually expand the marketplace. But with that in mind, let me turn it over to David.
Thanks, Nick. The two metrics I'll reference, one is what is the average basket size increase for our patients or customers that are using the card, and it's been trending towards 20%, which is a significant number. And that's relative to patients who had a purchasing history with us and relative to our average basket size in those markets. And most of that data comes out of New York, where we piloted the CNC card. And what's encouraging is New York has our highest average daily basket size. And so we're encouraged that this is going to be a great tool, as Nick mentioned, to be used in other markets that will arguably have, in our, from our expectations in its early days in the new markets, a similar, if not more, sort of increase in the basket size for patients who decide to use this card.
Okay, great. Appreciate that. And if I heard correctly, the plan is to expand the program to the rest of your operating states by the end of the year?
Yes. Correct.
And is this something where – sorry, go ahead. Is this, you know, based on, you know, Nick, you talked about this is a challenge for everyone in the industry and, you know, pretty innovative program so far. Is this something that you'd look to eventually expand to other dispensary chains, or is this something you want to keep just in-house for the time being?
No, we think that this is something that's well-suited for scale across the country. And I think that the idea for us is that we've done the work. We've proven out the model. We've gotten, we're getting to the point where we feel very comfortable that all of the infrastructure is there. Now, this has been a collaborative effort, and it will take time, but the idea is to provide a turnkey solution to the industry and to, there's an old saying that rising tide lifts all boats, and we think that this is one of those moments in time where you could see a sea change in the way people think about the industry and by removing one of the most important stigmas. So it's just a matter of time, and you know, fortunately, we've had a lot of incoming interest from everyone, from financial sponsors to investment banks to other parties in the industry. And what we like is that, you know, there's a lot of competition in the industry, but this is also an industry where people are learning as we're driving the bus. And you know, what's good for one party is good for other parties. And so we hope that this becomes a real opportunity to sort of show how an industry can develop in a more collaborative fashion than sometimes we're accustomed to seeing.
Got it, understood. And last question for me here, just to wrap up on the credit card program. You're talking a lot about leveraging data and the insights you get and your history of collecting that data. I was wondering if the credit card program provides any sort of new or a different way to analyze data. That's providing you some different insights than, you know, the historical data collection platform.
This is actually because credit and consumer credit is such a sensitive issue, we've actually ring-fenced it away from the rest of our organization because we don't want to ever be in a position where we don't have explicit permission to be able to use the data that we collect. And so I think that, you know, potentially it could be a source of data, but today, and because of the way the state regulatory frameworks work for credit and credit providers, we're viewing this as a very narrowly focused opportunity.
Okay, that's great. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of John Rolfe Crescent from Crescent Rock Capital. Please proceed with your next question.
Hey, guys. Two questions. One, you mentioned towards the end of your prepared comments, you know, gross and EBITDA margins that you think or expect a vertically integrated business like yours should ultimately command. Can you talk a bit about what you think, you know, those margins should look like at scale and what sort of revenue run rate you think you're going to need in order to sort of reach or approach the targets?
Well, just let me take your second question first. The revenue run rate question is complicated to answer because if we look at it on a blended basis, if we assume that we have 20 more markets to consolidate in the United States alone, you're always going to see some impact on an aggregate basis of the new markets, especially if they're de novo markets, where we're opening up and you're going to see that bolus, that sort of overburdened J curve that will depress our margins. Long term, and I think this is probably a key, we haven't given guidance specifically on the way to that we think we can achieve the type of margin profile that I referenced earlier. What I can tell you is that I think unlike many of our competitors, although we do have flower-based products and a flower-based product line and brands that's basically are traditionally associated with flower consumption, the preponderance of our innovation dollars and R&D and IP is in differentiated products that either use combinations, patentable combinations of cannabinoids or excipients along with those combination of cannabinoids or delivery devices in combination with all of the above to create differentiated products that will command a premium price in the market. And that's one of the reasons why we focus on health and wellness, because health and wellness consumers and medical consumers are accustomed to paying for that type of value, more so than somebody who's just looking to have a good time at the Pink Floyd laser show. So when we think about the way the market is evolving and the types of demographics that are really driving growth, especially in the newer markets, it's predominantly women and baby boomers are the fastest growing demographic segments. There are people who are they may be purchasing through what a politician would characterize as a adult use framework, but they're actually health and wellness consumers. They don't consider themselves recreational because they're using our products as part of a, let's call it a daily regime, as a substitute to another form of therapy or as a complement to an existing form of therapy. And when I say therapy, I don't just mean someone who's going through chemotherapy. I'm talking about people who just have aches and pains, or people who have headaches, or people who have sleeping issues, or people who have anxiety. It's a much, much more balanced approach to product development and innovation based on what we know about the people who are coming through our front door. And really, our innovation is a response to what they are telling us we need. And that's sort of, let's call it the 80% or 75% of the new products we see developing that will drive a disproportionate share of our margin going forward. On the other side, we also have, let's call it the category of products that are most likely to be reimbursed, right? And you're going to have a different margin profile there. But to hit those gross and operating margins, it really comes down to product mix, and it comes down to the differentiated platform you're able to create and the lifetime value of those consumers. So when David talks about the average basket size of a consumer in New York, right, that has a huge implication to what the importance of every patient we see in that market is, because the basket size is so significant. And our goal is to make sure that we have similar relationships and similar stickiness across the board by offering differentiated products relative to our competitors.
Okay. Thank you for that. And last question, with the acceleration of sort of future year CapEx into this year, what would you guys expect in terms of CapEx spend for the back half of the year?
We haven't provided that guidance, but we do have two quarters of CapEx, right?
So we do, and it'll remain at a high level. I think that's maybe the closest we can give you as far as an indicator, right? We're halfway through the year. We've done very good progress in building out, but we still have some wood to chop, as we say. So it'll remain at a fairly high level over the next couple of quarters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at our first two quarters, and if you sort of compare that to our expectation that all of our markets will be, our goal is to have every market generating revenue by the end of this year. If that's our goal, that means the disproportionate investment that we need to make to turn those licenses into operational assets and revenue generating assets should be done by the end of this calendar year. So I would use sort of the first half of the year as sort of a benchmark for what we would expect to see going into the second half of the year, with the assumption that we're actually sort of swinging hammers at a much more rapid rate in this sort of third quarter and the fourth quarter than we were in the second quarter.
So can I conclude from that, if I look at your cash burn in 2Q and sort of roll that forward a couple quarters and then assume you're revenue positive and hopefully closer to break even by year end, that you're still comfortable with your current capital position in terms of getting yourself to the point where you're self-sustaining?
Yes.
Great. Okay, thanks very much.
Now, just to be very clear, that's correct.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Russell Stanley with Beacon Securities. Please proceed with your question.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for taking my questions. Just a few state-specific questions to follow up. Thanks for the thoughts on California. I apologize if I missed it, but I guess what's the latest timeline on the manufacturing facility you have planned for that market, and when do you think that'll be online?
So we expect to have that online by the end of September.
Great. And similarly, just moving over to New Jersey, can you provide a bit of an update on the build out there? When you think you might get doors open in that state?
We expect that to be open and generating revenue by end of year.
Great. And just to wrap up, thanks for the comments around Florida targeting 20, hopefully by the end of the year. Can you provide some color, I guess, as to how many locations you've secured to date, whether it's by leases or some other metric?
So we have 17 leases signed, and we have a number of LOIs that have been agreed to.
Excellent. That's all I have. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Mike Regan with MJ Business. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thanks. Actually, my question was already asked. It was basically about trying to, I guess, the way you think about sort of the normalized margins once you're in the steady state and past all the build-outs. I guess just one way to think about it in terms of the, just looking back at sort of the prior gross margins being more in the high 30s to, mid-50s, is that sort of more a more normalized way to think about the gross margins that you've experienced in the prior year?
You broke up just a little bit. Would you mind repeating that question? I apologize.
Oh, sure. My question was basically previously asked. I guess asked another way on just thinking about the way you could get to the normalized gross margins when you're past the build-outs and not wholesaling as much and selling most of your own production. I think in the year ago period, your gross margin was closer to 40% versus the 28 from this period. So is that a more normalized gross margin, think about as you go forward once all the production is now fully in-house and you're not wholesaling as much?
We would expect to see a consolidated gross margin well north of 50% on a steady state basis. We've been, when we think about that, and product mix is a main determinant, but, there are certain markets where we have a much higher gross margin than what you're seeing on a consolidated basis, simply because we either are just opening up and, we have a significant cost structure associated with the actual growing of our first harvest, or there are markets where we don't have cultivation and manufacturing online yet, so we're buying things wholesale. But the amount of seepage we're seeing on at the margin level because we haven't yet completed our portfolio is pretty significant. We see the power of a fully integrated model when we can actually get up and running.
Oh, that makes sense. Great. Thanks a lot.
We have no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the floor back over to management for closing remarks.
Thank you, Devin. As a reminder, we'll be presenting at Canaccord's Growth Conference in Boston tomorrow morning at 8:30 a.m. You can access a webcast of our presentation as well as find a calendar of upcoming events we'll be presenting at in the investors section of our website at www.col-care.com. Thanks once again for joining today's call.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation and have a wonderful day.